Erdogan's new president tells his Turkish counterpart that Tehran and Ankara will continue to defend Palestinians in the face of Israel's oppression. Israel and Morocco signed 3 accords as the Israeli foreign minister visits Rabat less than a year after the two sides normalized ties. Also ahead, the Taliban denies targeting and killing civilians during an offensive against Afghan government troops, calling for an independent investigation. Welcome to World News. Our top story, the Iranian president says Tehran and Ankara will continue to support the defenseless people of Palestine against Israeli oppression. Ibrahim Raisi made the remark during a phone conversation with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Raisi noted that close cooperation between the two countries is essential to establish security and stability in the region. Erdogan, for his part, told the Iranian president that Tehran-Ankara relations would undoubtedly expand under Raisi's administration. Israel's foreign minister has met with Moroccan officials in the first visit by a top Israeli official to the kingdom in 18 years. Yair Lapid and his Moroccan counterpart Nasir Bourouti signed 3 agreements during the visit. The development comes days after direct flights between Israel and Morocco were launched. The trip also comes after rights groups last month accused the kingdom of having used Israeli spyware, Pegasus, an allegation Rabat has denied. Israel and Morocco struck a normalization deal last year after U.S. President Donald Trump recognized Morocco's contested sovereignty over the Western Sahara. When it comes to Israel's illegal actions in the occupied territories, they have continued unabated, even with the not-so-new administration headed by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. No surprises there, since no matter who has been in office in Israel, illegal apartheid actions have continuously taken place. In this instance, demolitions in the Sinwar neighborhood occurred with planned evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, another neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, to happen in the near future.
It is seen as yet another atrocity committed by Israeli forces against Palestinians. Israeli forces have torn down a Palestinian house in Silwan town in occupied East Al-Quds. The house was demolished by Israeli bulldozers, which were backed by Israeli forces. Israeli forces cited lack of a building permit for demolishing the house, which was built 10 years ago. Local Palestinian sources say Israeli authorities claim that Palestinian homes were built without permits, but the fact is that they do not grant permits for the Palestinians to build their homes. The Israeli demolition policy is part of the regime's efforts to obliterate the Palestinian presence in Silwan neighborhood. Israeli authorities have recently announced plans to demolish dozens of Palestinian homes in Al-Bustan and Batin al-Hawa neighborhoods in Silwan. International law regards both the West Bank and East Al-Quds as occupied territories and considers all Israeli settlement building activity there illegal. Israeli authorities demolish Palestinian homes in the West Bank, usually claiming that the residential structures have been built without the relevant building permits, which are almost impossible to obtain.
But they have gone on record to say that they must maintain a 70% Jewish, 30% Palestinian population ratio at the maximum. And so therefore Palestinians are being driven from their homes in order to preserve this Jewish majority. And it is racism, racist ethnic cleansing. There's no discussion about it. It's a public position of the Israeli regime.
The United Nations has repeatedly called on Israel to halt its demolition and confiscation of Palestinian property and adhere to its obligation as an occupying power under international humanitarian law.
So far, the CF-57 demolitions, evictions, confiscations or seizures of Palestinian properties have taken place in East Al-Quds from 2006 until 2018. Israel demolished at least 1,360 Palestinian homes in occupied West Bank, not including East Al-Quds, causing thousands of Palestinians to lose their homes. This is part of the Israeli policy of ethnic cleansing.
More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. Since Israel seized East Al-Quds in the 1967 war, Israeli settler organizations have claimed ownership of land in Sheikh Jarrah and have filed multiple lawsuits to evict Palestinians from the area.
Ethnic cleansing, which has gone on every day and week and month and year since 1948, where land has been taken from Palestinian into exclusively Jewish ownership and which can never be returned to the Palestinian owners.
Earlier this year, an Israeli district court in Al-Quds ruled the homes of the four families legally belonged to Jewish families. Sheikh Jarrah has been the scene of frequent crackdowns by Israeli police on Palestinians protesting against the threatened expulsion of dozens of Palestinian families from their homes in favor of hardline Israeli settler groups. The Sheikh Jarrah protests in May coincided with a decision by the Israeli regime to ban gatherings in the Muslim holy month of Ramadan at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Al-Quds and riots by far-right Jewish groups. That prompted Palestinian resistance fighters to respond to Israel's atrocities by firing rockets into Israel.
In my own opinion, I don't think the Biden administration wants the ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem and the West Bank. I don't think they care. I think if the Israelis are driving this forward, which they are, and Biden has an alliance with Israel, then he will be prepared to pay the price in Palestinian ethnic cleansing. So I don't think Biden's trying to gain time. I don't think he cares very much, and I think he's prepared to allow Israel to continue.
The administration of US President Biden has practically done nothing to stop Israel's expansionist policies. The Biden administration appears neither willing nor interested in the Palestinian-Israel conflict. It seems to be buying time for Israel so that the Tel Aviv regime can continue to increase its illegal activities like settlements, evictions, and demolitions.
The Taliban have denied reports of targeting and killing civilians in their offensive against the Afghan government forces. In a statement, the militant group called for an independent investigation into the matter, adding that all its attacks have been carried out with precision and caution. The statement came after the United Nations said over 1,000 civilians have been killed during the clashes over the past month. The Taliban have stepped up their fight against the Afghan government and have so far captured 9 of 34 provincial capitals in the country. Their advances led to the Afghan president replacing the country's army chief on Wednesday. Political commentator Keaton Mansfield says regional powers can assist the Afghan government in the conflict with the Taliban.
The United States has said in internal documents as well as publicly on news stations that part of the concern of Biden planning to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan on the anniversary of the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center 9/11, that China or Iran or both would sweep into Afghanistan to help the Afghan government reclaim control over their territories and expel the terrorist cells within there. And so I think that is most likely the best option for the situation. Of course, that is reliant on the request of the Afghan government. but cooperation with Russia, Iran, Syria, China, to be able to first rebuild the economy of Afghanistan.
With the emergence of the novel coronavirus in late 2019 in China, life was upended for billions of people worldwide. The virus, which soon caused a pandemic, has exacted a heavy cost on economies and inflicted heavy loss of life. The invention of vaccines became a beacon of hope to many around the world, but nearly a year after the first COVID-19 jabs were administered, the pandemic still rages on, and fair distribution remains a distant goal.
All the figures point to one fact. COVID-19 vaccine distribution is not fair. To date, over 4.5 billion jabs have been administered worldwide, according to data from the University of Oxford. Wealthy countries have consumed the lion's share of vaccines, with more than 4 out of 5 doses given to people living in high and upper middle income countries. Low-income nations have administered less than 0.5% of shots. To further illustrate the wide divide, we can look at the statistics of the United States. The country has administered over 350 million doses. That translates to 106 doses per 100 American. In Africa, that number is around 6 per 100 people. To make matters worse, as some countries have not been able to even kick off their vaccination campaigns, rich nations are considering giving additional jabs to people already fully inoculated. Germany, France, Russia, and the UAE have already started offering booster shots, while the US and the UK have announced or hinted at plans to do so in the near future. This has caused much outrage among activists. Most recently, a group of campaigners slammed Britain for ordering millions of booster jabs, saying the UK is effectively pushing poor countries to the back of the vaccine queue. The World Health Organization has called for a halt on boosters through at least by the end of September. The UN health body urged rich nations to give shots to the poorer countries that are struggling to inoculate even their highly vulnerable populations. But the US almost immediately rejected the plea, saying it has already donated more doses than any other country. That does not seem to have convinced the WHO. On Tuesday, the organization again slammed the existing divides in COVID-19 vaccine distributions as disgraceful and called for a more equitable approach. It said the power to overturn the imbalance lies in the hands of only 20 leaders around the world. The World Health Organization says it wants every country to have vaccinated at least 10% of its population by the end of September. But with the current pace of vaccination drive in the world's underprivileged nations, that goal might be too hard to achieve.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the COVID-19 pandemic is the main problem the country is facing. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urged officials to provide vaccines both through imports and domestic production. He also slammed some foreign countries for failing to abide by their promises to provide vaccines to Iranians. Iran has seen a surge in cases and fatalities caused by the highly infectious Delta variant. In the past 24 hours, more than 42,000 people tested positive for the virus, which is the country's highest daily caseload since the start of the pandemic. 541 people also lost their lives, bringing the total death toll to more than 95,000. An Iranian-made COVID-19 vaccine dubbed Noura has wrapped up its first human trial phase. Developers of the new jab say the vaccine also provides immunity for children between 12 and 20, besides adults as well. Yusuf Jalali has the details.
Meet Noura, an Iranian-made COVID vaccine, which is now making a name for itself. Developed by Iran's Baghiyat Allah University, affiliated to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the vaccine wrapped up the first human trial stage and now kick-started the second phase.
The first trial phase involved giving the jabs to 70 people. The vaccine has not created any serious side effects in the volunteers, so we can now conclude that the vaccine is safe. The second phase will cover up to 500 volunteers, and the third and final stage will inject Nura to at least 20,000 people. It's only then we can decide on the efficiency of the vaccine.
Nura is a recombinant vaccine, which experts say provides stronger immune response to the virus compared to jabs that work based on other methods, such as mRNA and inactivated virus. Nura is administered in three stages. The first and second doses are injected 21 days apart, and the third one is administered 2 weeks after the second shot.
Well, Nura jumped a bit late on the bandwagon to fight the coronavirus. It stands out as the only Iranian vaccine that can be administered to children and teens. Experts hope that this would make it safe to reopen schools.
With less than 1 month and a half left to the upcoming school season, authorities in Iran are still debating whether or not to resume in-person classes, which have in the past year given way to online learning. Nura developers say they're trying their best to get their jabs to the market, as they're certain that their vaccine will protect children between 12 and 18 against the coronavirus.
Based on our studies, our vaccine is both safe and effective to be used for people between 12 and 18 years old. Simultaneously with the second trial phase, we'll also kickstart the first stage of the trials on volunteers from this age group.
Developers say if all goes as planned, Nura will hit the market in 3 months. This as Iran has already rolled out its first local vaccine dubbed Coviran, with a monthly output of up to 15 million doses per month. The country also plans to release Covpars, among other jabs, within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
in the limelight.
New study shows Chinese universities will produce nearly twice as many STEM PhD graduates than the United States by 2025. They're prepared through an article written by Scott Foster, a graduate of Stanford University and the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. The piece is titled U.S. Falling Further Behind China in STEM PhDs. The article was published by the Asia Times. Earlier article entitled China-US Contest Will Come Down to Education, I wrote about the crisis in American primary and secondary education. As promised then, this article addresses the relative decline of American universities in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. This change is not readily apparent. A large share of the best universities in the world are allegedly in the United States. For example, the 7th annual ranking of the best global universities conducted by U.S. News & World Report and published in October of 2020 claimed that 19 of the top 25 schools were American. However, the arguably more internationally minded QS World University Ranking, published by UK company Coccarelli Simons in July this year, found that 12 of the top 25 universities were in the United States, 5 in the United Kingdom, 3 were in China, 2 each in Singapore and Switzerland, and 1 in Japan. Then, at the beginning of August, the Center for Security and Emerging Technology, CSET, at Georgetown University in Washington issued a report entitled China is Fast Outpacing U.S. STEM PhD Growth, which concluded that, based on current enrollment patterns, we project that by 2025, Chinese universities will produce more than 77,000 STEM PhD graduates per year, compared to approximately 40,000 in the United States. Of course, Chinese universities primarily educate Chinese students, while American universities are geared to supposedly educating the world. Thus, the Georgetown University study found if international students are excluded from the U.S. count, Chinese STEM PhD graduates would outnumber their U.S. counterparts more than 3-1. China overtook the United States in the number of STEM PhDs, that is science, technology, engineering and mathematics PhDs in 2007 and was 47% ahead by 2019. The change has been rapid and it remains so. The quality of Chinese university level STEM education is also improving. The CSET, the Center for Security and Emerging Technology at Georgetown University, study found that most of the recent and rapid growth in Chinese PhD enrollments comes from universities within the higher quality tiers, and because more than three-quarters of Chinese doctoral graduates specialize in STEM fields, this evidence indicates China's STEM talent pipeline is becoming more robust. And not surprisingly, given the scale of China's investments in higher education and the high-stakes technology competition between the United States and China, the gap in STEM PhD production could undermine U.S. long-term economic and national security. Remco Swetsloot, one of the authors of the CSET report, was quoted in Axios website as warning, "If this continues, there seems to be no way the United States can continue competing with China on the talent front without immigration reform. It is just a numbers game. Because a large percentage of American students are not prepared for graduate studies in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the U.S. depends on foreign students to fill its universities and pay the bills. And it has been alienating foreign students, particularly Chinese students, who accounted for about one-third of foreign students in the U.S. before Donald Trump's anti-China rhetoric and tighter immigration controls. Efforts under both Trump and President Biden to exclude Chinese students from advanced STEM research also have had an impact. And according to Xiaofeng Wan, Amherst College Associate Dean of Admission and Coordinator of International Recruitment, there's also been a considerable impact from the physical and verbal violence that ultimately resulted in over 6,600 reported racially motivated attacks against the Asian community, especially the elderly and women. Xiaofeng Wan notes that Chinese students contributed $15 billion to the U.S. economy in the 2018-2019 school year, when enrollments of foreign students peaked. Another report says foreign students' enrollment kept American universities afloat, rising by 55% from 2011 to 2019, while domestic enrollment stagnated. After that, the COVID-19 pandemic caused international student numbers to crash worldwide, and the Delta variant puts recent signs of recovery at risk. President Biden's election has led to a more open immigration policy, but Amherst's Xiaofeng Wan is probably correct when he says that a full recovery to pre-pandemic levels will take time for the Biden administration to simply distance itself from Trump-era anti-immigrant rules and ideologies may not be enough to fully rebuild many Chinese families' lost sense of confidence. Study, a UK-based organization that specializes in study abroad programs, repeats a claim on its website. For decades, the United States has reigned supreme as the world's most popular study abroad destination. But a closer look at its own data shows that while the United States is the country that attracts the largest number of foreign students, in 2019, only 26% of the total number attracted by the top 10 countries surveyed studied in the United States. The United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia together accounted for 32%, and China for 12%. The number of international students in China was almost the same as the number in the United Kingdom, while Canada and Australia were close behind. China attracted 46% as many students as the United States, despite its short history as a country with modern universities. Most foreign students in China are from other Asian countries, led by South Korea, but there are substantial numbers from the United States, Russia, and France. Finally, let's return to the CSET ranking, which includes 100 universities in total. Of these, 29 are in the United States, 17 are in the United Kingdom, 17 in continental Europe, and 12 in China. 5 of those are in Hong Kong, and 1 is in Taiwan. 8 in Australia and New Zealand, 6 in South Korea, 5 in Japan, 3 in Singapore and Malaysia combined, 2 in Canada, and 1 in Argentina. Grouping them culturally and politically shows 29 in the United States, 30 in the British Commonwealth, which does not include Hong Kong, 17 in continental Europe, 12 in Greater China, 11 in South Korea and Japan, and 1 in Latin America. Or 73 in North America, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand, 26 in East Asia, 1 in Latin America, and none at all in South Asia and Africa. Clearly, the scale and diversity of university excellence in the West the rise of East Asian university education and the educational weakness of other regions are phenomena as significant as the relative decline of the United States. As Winston Churchill put it in a speech at Harvard University in 1943, the empires of the future are the empires of the mind. China is evolving from cheap hand assembly to fully automated manufacturing and has a huge internet sector. It has built the world's largest high-speed train network, put a rover on Mars, and launched its own space station. All this requires first-rate STEM education, which in China is supported by a government of engineers rather than lawyers. Most likely, when it comes to nation building, the education data will continue to evolve in its favor.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady here from IRIB English Radio. Inshallah ta'ala, we are going to be having a series of discussions regarding the topic of women of Ashura or Ashura in women. In the studio, as always, I have the pleasure and honor of having my lovely sister and friend and wonderful guest, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister.
So, Sister Razia, we were talking about women who played great roles throughout history, especially during the events of Karbala and Ashura and whatever happened afterwards.
Yeah, but we had an incomplete topic last session.
Exactly, and we were talking about more contemporary figures, closer to our time, perhaps more relatable.
Right. One tool that we Shiites have, and I'm an Iranian woman, and I see that in every alley during the 2 months of Muharram and Safar, you see that every other house, like every 10 houses, you can see a house that has Rosa or morning session for Abu Abdullah and all the martyrs of Karbala. Or when there's a happy occasion, there's a celebration of a birthday anniversary of an imam or the Mab'ath or Eid al-Adha. On any occasion, they try to revive the custom, the teachings of Islam by celebrating it, by honoring that, occasion, and by analyzing what they can get, because these young new lecturers that are attending these morning sessions or celebration sessions, they're really trying to educate people, rather than just talking about a historical event that took place years and years ago and then that's finished. They're really trying to relate it to people's present day lives and how we can learned from them. And talking about Sayyida Bintul Huda al-Sadr and how she had sessions in her own house, I was reminded of other ladies in the history of time that used this platform. Ladies, platform. You have a great free access in your disposal, which is your houses, right? Each of these are Husseiniya. I remember in the beginning of the Corona, Sayyid Ali Khamenei would say that, our supreme leader would say that, turn your houses, if you cannot go outside, if you cannot
attend the majalis,
turn your house into a Husseiniya, every house a Husseiniya. So this is a great Shiite teaching that we have. And alhamdulillah, mashallah, many, many women throughout history have taught us and have proved very effective how this platform could be. One was Sayyida Bintul Huda Sadr, Sayyida Zainab, who was a Mufassir, who is an interpreter of the Quran, a very knowledgeable lady. She was a lady who did not have a teacher, but she was a scholar, a very knowledgeable person. And then again, another lady who was influential in the event of Ashura was Maria bint Sa'd.
Yeah.
She was a brave Shiite woman in the city of Basra, and she had turned her house into a Husseiniyah, as we call it right now, or they would call it a center for the Shiites. They would go to her house and they would like get the latest news, and she was welcoming to all the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, and she had put at the disposal of the Shiites whatever she had, you know, she had in her, within her power. And she was aware, fully aware of Imam Hussein's uprising, which was to revive the sunnah of the Prophet, his grandfather, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, and her house actually served that purpose. So among the people, the participants of the Day of Ashura were some of the people who actually, you know, were active participants of her house, in her house. So this is again something that we could do, a platform that we could use.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's so simple, so easy. Not too schmancy, nothing extravagant or over the top, just gatherings that we could have and to talk about life issues with an Islamic Ashura'i approach. I think women should do that more often. We should create such niche for ourselves, these safe places to deal with women's issues.
These places served multi-purposes.
Mm.
One, it was a chance to get to know about the teachings of the Quran, tafsir, ahkam, aqaid, you know, doctrines of belief, all this. And, you know, it was an informal platform so that to increase the level of knowledge of women, housewives usually, who were busy with their raising kids and, you know, taking care of their husbands and their, you know, houses and everything. It was a platform to freshen them up, to keep them up to date of how Islam wants them to serve, right? By the way, there's a beautiful explanation or beautiful tafsir for Al-Hafidhat in about Surah Nisa, verse number 34. الرجال قوامون على النساء. And then it says فالصالحات قانتات. One professor was saying that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives men the authority or the, you know, the power or the function of supporting and maintaining women, and on the other hand also he raises women up. Mm-hmm. Says that فالصالحات, you God fearing virtuous women who are so dear in my eyes, you are qanitatun, salihatun, this and that. So, I mean, I'm talking about housewives who are taking care of their, raising their children and taking care of their husband's needs. And in our time, in our age, in you know, one or two decades ago, three, 4 decades ago, these have turned into very looked down upon kind of things to do, being a housewife. What do? You're a housewife? You do nothing.
Right.
These majalis that Shiite women have as their platform, one is to educate women, two, share their feelings and sentiments.
Exactly.
To empty
which is
themselves.
Important. Yeah, it's important, man.
At this day, a lot of young boys and girls are in search of a good spouse.
Yeah.
And because of the corona, there's a big gap between people. All these social gatherings and contributions have been limited to really little numbers, and so there's not a great chance of meeting new people. And in the old days, these majalis served as a very good means for women to introduce, you know, their children to one another, and good marriages.
There's so much potential in these gatherings, and perhaps one of the reasons the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam emphasized on it so much and encouraged us to uphold these majalis of the remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt. Like, to have these majalis, supposedly, okay, we spend half an hour talking about, I don't know, the tafsir of the verse in the Quran,
yeah,
right? And then after that, we have tea, some cake, and we talk and we chat and we refresh ourselves and, you know,
pour out your pains and agonies and frustrations and challenges in life, and you get some really good solutions.
And, you know, you offer one another support.
Exactly.
So many women live in certain...
similar situations, even worse situations. Exactly. You compare some, oh my God, I'm in such a better situation.
Sometimes they can't turn to their families. They don't have anyone to lean on. And it's nice to have that...
ear, comforting ear.
Exactly. And that shoulder and that safe place. We're going to go on a short break and we're going to be right back. So don't go anywhere. Studio with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're discussing Ashura'i women and Ashura in women.
Actually, these majalis took place right after the Shahada or the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. These ladies at that time who were living in the city of Medina, I think one of them was Umm al-Banin, who turned to her house, or who started this whole sunnah of crying. I mean, beside Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, who mourned and who had majalis in his house
for 30 years.
Also, these ladies also in the city of Medina, they had their houses as a platform to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So we learn it. We Shiites learn the sunnah from our imams, from our leaders in the beginning, in the first century
absolutely. So let's shift the focus of our discussion a little toward the women in Ashura, who in a way began this movement after Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, in continuation of his mission. I don't know which one was harder, to be honest.
Which
to be the man yielding the sword, holding a shield, and raging into enemy front lines in a face-to-face battle and then giving up an arm, a leg, and then dying, or being a woman
and staying behind.
Exactly. And with a mountain of grief, undetermined way, journey, future ahead, in the middle of a bunch the same jackals that just slaughtered and shred apart your loved ones, now you're left with them. Exactly. As a vulnerable woman without a sword, God knows what's going to happen after this.
And prior to this, you were safeguarded as the amana,
exactly, like a gem,
trustee of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now you're just left in the hands of
a captive. You're literally a captive. And I think that's why Imam Sajjad alayhi salam said asham. It was definitely worse than watching the most beloved people in my life being slaughtered in cold blood.
Yeah. When they told me to talk about, like they said that the topic is the ladies, the role of the, you know, women in the uprising of Ashura, I was like, okay, so there are a handful of women and, you know, there's this lady, that lady, you know, about like 20 ladies that I can talk about. But then I was like, so let us, as you said, let us dissect and analyze and get like the just the gem of, you know, what this quality was in them, the qualities that you could find in them that you can learn from, you know, in our own sizes, in our own ways,
in our own capacity,
personalizing it, as they say, localizing it. So these ladies... One of the salient attributes of a lady is that she's full of mercy, compassion, and kindness. And in the midst of all this barbaric, harsh, violent, cruel, lifeless moments on the plain of Ashura, this gentleness, this flowerness, this kindness still remained. Where you see that in Sayyida Zainab, salamullah alayha. She had all these captives, all these orphans,
these widows, heartbroken wives and mothers,
and these little girls and boys who were the apple of their father's eye,
right,
probably like the day before or half a day before, now they all had turned into orphans, right? And it was so difficult for her, having lost her brother, her sons, her nephews, and to still, because I would, like, I'm like, when I am under a lot of agony and pressure, I would lose this kindness of mine. I'm like, you know, don't you understand? I have a lot to grieve.
Exactly.
You shouldn't expect from me to be kind, you know?
Exactly.
But she was kind towards all these orphan. I mean, this character was very vivid in her, and I really like it in her. I was actually watching an Instagram clip today where they had turned this into, maybe I'll put it for you in our next episode. It is. I started to cry afterward.
Oh, it was
beautiful.
Inshallah.
I'm going to share with you, inshallah.
That's all the time we have for today's episode of Muslim Lady. Thank you so very much for being with us. Until another segment, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out aloud that on that day I'll be okay.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
When President John F. Kennedy took office in 1961, he needed Senate approval for 779 of his appointments. That was a highly irrational way to run a government. 60 years later, despite efforts at reform and widespread recognition of the irrationality, President Biden needs Senate approval for 1,237 positions, an increase of 59%, as a new report from the Partnership for Public Service discloses. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Fred Hyatt, a journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Government is Designed for Failure, and a new study shows it's getting worse. Stay tuned for more. When President John F. Kennedy took office in 1961, he needed Senate approval for 779 of his appointments. That was a highly irrational way to run a government. 60 years later, despite efforts at reform and widespread recognition of the irrationality, President Biden needs Senate approval for 1,237 positions, an increase of 59%, as a new report from the Partnership for Public Service discloses. Americans have gone from irrational to just plain crazy. How crazy? The Post and the Partnership are tracking 799 of those positions, leaving out some advisory boards and less essential jobs. As of this week, only 112 of them have been filled. More than 6 months into his presidency, in other words, more than an eighth of the way through his term, Biden hardly has the beginning of an executive team in place. Recently, a visiting diplomat told Express he was struck by the disconnect between Biden's ambitious rhetoric about rebuilding alliances, promoting democracy, standing up to adversaries, and his meager agenda. He asked, "Where are the policies? This isn't entirely fair. These are policies, but it's difficult to put meat on the bones of any agenda without ambassadors, assistant secretaries of state, and defense for different regions in the world, and more." At about this point of every administration, you start to see stories assigning blame for the empty offices. Republicans will ask why Biden has nominated only 323 of the 799. Administration officials would say there is not much point in stacking up another few hundred nominees for obstructionists such as Senator Ted Cruz, who has been holding up State Department nominees to grandstand his opposition to the administration's stance on a Russia-Germany natural gas pipeline. But the better question is, why do things this way in the first place? Start with the 4,000 political positions every administration has to fill. This is totally out of line with every other democracy, says Max Steyer, who heads the partnership. It undercuts the professional civil service and promotes a kind of short-term thinking, since the average tenure for Senate confirmed appointees is about 2 years. Unfortunately, most of the challenges facing the society and the government can't be solved in 2 years. In 1997, the General Accounting Office cited cyber policy as a high-risk area for the federal government. Are we surprised that decades later it remains so? Climate change, equipping the government with appropriate technology, retraining the workforce for a changing economy, these all demand long-range thinking. So, as Americans have sadly been reminded, thus preparing for public health emergencies, requiring that 1,237 of those 4,000 political positions win Senate confirmation compounds the damage. And this situation discourages qualified people from serving. The partnership reports that nominees during the Reagan administration waited an average of 56 days to be confirmed. By the Obama and Trump administrations, the waiting time had doubled to 112 days and 117 days, respectively. And that doesn't count the excruciating pre-nomination months when prospective appointees are being vetted by the White House. During the Obama administration, nominees spent a culminative 452 years bogged down in the confirmation process. Torture for them, but bad for the Senate too, which has to take time away from legislating. And debilitating for the government. Even after 2 years, many of the jobs will be unfilled. According to Vanderbilt University professor David E. Lewis, 30% of positions in the past three administrations never received a nomination in the first half of a term. Steyer says, I'm not saying you solve this problem and everything else disappears, but if you don't solve this problem, everything else stays indefinitely harder. And how do you solve it? You could start by abolishing some of the jobs altogether. One study found an average of 83 layers between top leadership and essential workers in federal agencies, the report says. The report found at least 40 positions that have been vacant since June 2016. If they have managed this long without anyone in those jobs, let's take a look at those positions. But more to the point, the Senate and the executive branch could agree to radically diminish the number of political positions and the number requiring confirmation. Have the change take place in the future, so everyone's political calculation is uncertain. The Senate could insist on true accountability, confirm the truly senior positions, let those officials appoint the teams they want, and then hold those executives responsible for results. In turn, those executives would have an experienced, empowered civil service to rely on, with institutional memory and long-term commitment. The country would have a government capable of taking on complex problems. Imagine the board of directors of a large corporation appointing a new chief executive and then forcing that executive to operate without a team for months and even years. Shareholders wouldn't stand for such absurdity. Why should taxpayers?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website.